from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the fantasy sports site DraftKings says it's going public.
This pretty much leaves DraftKings' destiny in Boston still. And so I think it's great, and I think they're going to keep growing that workforce.
Also today, a decade of social movements. What led America back to protest and activism?
There's always a sense that the generation before you didn't quite get it done, and now you have to step up and do that.
And we break down the biggest hits of the decade as we look back at the 2010s in music.
It's just catapulted the worldwide influence, you know, the world's influence on music.
We'll take your calls. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It should be a slow holiday week, but we actually have a lot of business news to cover, so let's do that. The Boston-based fantasy sports site DraftKings is going public. The company says it's going to merge with an international gambling technology firm. It's a deal that's expected to close early next year, and then they'll take the new entity public under the DraftKings name. Also, on Friday, Waltham-based Care.com announced that it was being sold to a New York firm for about $500 million. Joining us on the line to make sense of all of it is John Chesto, business reporter for the Boston Globe. John, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So lots of big news here, John. What's the headline?
Well, the big news is DraftKings is finally figured out a way to get more cash to help its growth. And that involves going public and merging with a European company called SB Tech. That'll bring more technology to DraftKings' platform.
So this is about money to grow at the speed that they think they're going to need to, John?
Yeah, that's right. You know, DraftKings wants to be the dominant fantasy sports provider. And, of course, now that a number of states are legalizing sports betting, DraftKings also wants to be the dominant purveyor of sports bets. That's going to take a lot of money. Originally, DraftKings tried to merge with its chief rival, FanDuel, and the federal government did not take kindly to that. It was basically discouraged on antitrust grounds. So now they have to go it alone, and this is how DraftKings is going to go it alone. Given that they employ hundreds of people here in Boston at their headquarters, I think it's a good sign that they've been able to pull this deal together.
Well, that does kind of beg the question. They opened a big office in the Back Bay earlier this year. This is a cash infusion, as you referred to it. A lot more jobs. Is this good for Boston?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, sometimes when companies get acquired, it's usually bad for the community where the company is being acquired. But sometimes, in this case, you know, the management will remain the same. They're going to use the money that they're getting from this new investment as they go public to grow. So I think it is good for Boston. I think, you know, Boston has really been doing well in the consumer technology space. You know, we're not San Francisco or Silicon Valley, but we're definitely holding our own. And it's great to have a few flagship companies in the midst. DraftKings growing fast. Wayfair also comes to mind, another fast-growing company.
Should DraftKings' choice here tell us something about what they think the future of legalized gambling is, both in Massachusetts and, you know, nationally?
Well, I think they know that it's going to be more widely accepted as the states figure this out. You saw New Hampshire sped up when it's going to have its legalized sports betting. It's going to be next week. Rhode Island has been at it for a while now. They were one of the first states, and I think we're going to see more states do this. Massachusetts, the big question has been, when does Massachusetts take this on? There are a number of bills before the legislature. They are moving at a deliberate pace. They're not going to rush into it. They do not expect a huge amount of taxes to be gained from this, so they don't want to rush it. But I think we'll see a bill get signed into law in 2020 legalizing sports betting in Massachusetts.
So, John, let's talk about Care.com for a minute. You said in reference to DraftKings, this is one of those cases where an acquisition essentially is not going to be bad. Care.com is being bought for about $500 million by a New York company. What is that going to mean for Waltham, where they're based?
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a little more control out of New York now, which is not necessarily great for expansion in Waltham. They have just under 200 employees in Waltham, and I don't expect much growth in the future. I could be wrong. I've used care.com for our daughter finding a caregiver in the past, and I like it, but I understand the limitations. The screening process is, I think many people thought there was a better screening process for various aspects of the website than there was. Yeah, the Wall Street Journal story. They've been taking a hit on it for a while, but it wasn't until a Wall Street Journal story in March really outlined some of the problems that the stock, it really tanked the stock. Care.com has put new controls in place. The stock's improved somewhat, I think partly because investors did expect some sort of acquisition might be in the offing. The new CEO is going to come from the acquiring company, and so we're going to see, more decisions made out of the headquarters office in New York rather than from Waltham.
John, Sheila Marcello, the founder, as I understand it, will no longer be in charge of the company. So that's another business woman in Boston who now won't be a lead businesswoman in Boston. Does that send ripples across, the diversity questions in the community?
You know, I think she was heralded as one of the top female executives in the area, and there aren't that many, unfortunately, female CEOs in Boston, particularly that were running publicly traded companies. Of course, this is no longer going to be publicly traded once it gets acquired by IAC. I don't know if it's going to how much of an impact it's going to have. You could look at there's a group called the Massachusetts Competitive Partnership.
Hey, John, I'm sorry.
20.
I thought we were going to do a shorter answer that I got to move us on, but I do appreciate you joining us. John Chesto is a business reporter for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We often hear the holidays are a time of joy and cheer. It is not all cookies and smiles. The days are shorter, they're darker, they're colder. That can make a lot of us feel sad. Doctors say many people, some estimates say 10 million Americans, actually suffer from a more acute form of depression when the season changes, called seasonal affective disorder. Dr. Sanford Auerbach is an associate professor of neurology at Boston University School of Medicine. He stopped by Studio 3 recently to tell us how to recognize its symptoms.
Well, there are some people who particularly have a change in mood that it seems to be related to the seasons. The most common one that most people think about is the one that particularly affects people, usually starting late fall, early winter, as the days get shorter and colder, and usually associated with some type of depression, whether it's over depression, just a change in mood, lack of energy, increased sleep need, change in appetite. It can take a form of a lot of different physical symptoms, some which people are more keen to than others or tuned into more than others.
So is it actually a type of depression, or is it something that looks like depression?
Very good question. Very good question, which is actually, it's not very obvious. And in a lot of ways, it is a depression. And oftentimes people wonder, is depression just a single thing, or is there a lot of different types of depression? And it's also interesting in that people who become depressed, there's not just the mood change that people usually latch onto, but there are these other physical changes that occur with people, changes in their sleep patterns, changes in their appetite, in their lack of energy, or and so forth, that all are part of depression that people oftentimes don't think about.
And those are also present in seasonal affective
and
disorder.
And those are all components of seasonal affective disorder. Not everybody always has all of those features all at the same time. We even sometimes see people who don't feel that their mood is changed that much, but have a lot of these other physical symptoms. Should we call it depression? Should we call it something else? To me, oftentimes it's not as much as important as what we call it, is just recognizing this pattern or constellation of symptoms that people may get that seems to be related to a certain time of the year.
So that's the marker of seasonal affective disorder, is whether or not a set of symptoms like the ones you've just stated seem to correspond with changes in the season. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, yes. And it's complicated because a lot of people have latched on to the fact that it has to do with the changes in our light cycles. But there are a lot of other things that go on at the same time, and it's oftentimes in the individual person, it's hard to tease them apart. Is it really that the change in life cycles that they're suffering from, or is it the fact that the weather has changed, it's gloomy, it's cold, it's snowing, it's and so forth, and overcast? Or is it because there are a lot of holidays this time of year and it brings up certain factors, certain stress factors for some people more than others? So there are a lot of things going on all at the same time. The one sort of common factor that people have latched on to oftentimes is this notion of the shortening days.
Is that often a trigger?
It seems that way for certainly a large number of people. That seems to be the major trigger, is this shortening of the days.
And what is going on in the brain?
Well, there are a lot of things going on in the brain, and certainly there are changes in the neurochemistry of the brain that go on. We already know, even from studying sleep, that a lot of the neurochemistry of the brain is tightly linked to our biological rhythms, our circadian rhythms, which in turn are affected by light. Those are the very powerful pathways that go from the light to the part of the back of the eye, not necessarily the part of the back of the eye that's related to our seeing, the rods and cones, and then passage from there back to the deeper parts of the brain, and in terms involved with the regulation of a lot of other neurochemical substances within the substrate of our brain. The details of this interaction are difficult to tease apart, in part because a lot of the, like serotonin, for instance, or some of the other neurotransmitters, they're implicated not just in our mood, but also they're implicated in our sleep cycling. And, you know, are people affected, their sleep affect their mood, or mood affect their sleep? It becomes a very difficult intermixed problem.
I imagine there's some continuum between, let's say, what I experience, which is it makes me really grumpy that it's dark after I get out of work, all the way to I have seasonal affective disorder. How does one know if their experience of the darkness of the winter season elevates itself to the level of seasonal affective disorder?
Well, that's where the question comes up. How do people realize that they're grumpy or really depressed? You know, at what point does it interfere with their ability to enjoy themselves? At what point does it interfere with their ability to get things done on a day-to-day basis? At what point does it interfere with their interpersonal relationships? That's when it takes on the notion of this disorder. I think that it's fairly common that people develop some of these symptoms to a mild degree. Not as many people, you know, does it get to the point where it's a clinical problem?
How many people, for how many people does it become a clinical problem? What percentage of the population?
It's hard to know. My speculation is that it's at least 10 to 20% of the population that this would affect. And again, the problem is it's this whole gradation that you had mentioned, from you a little bit grumpy to, you know, maybe sleeping a little extra or change in appetite, to those people where it interferes with their day-to-day function. And again, some of the people who may have ongoing problems that just become more manifest at certain times of the year.
I suppose I should ask you, can the opposite happen? Could one experience these symptoms when the days get longer and the sun is out more and the weather is warmer?
Sure. The thing that we latch onto, because it's a nice, simple solution, is the mood change that occurs as the days get shorter. But by definition, these seasonal affective disorders can occur at any season. And there are some who may have particular problems in the spring and summer months.
What are the treatment options, Dr. Auerbach?
Well, very often, particularly for this seasonal affective depression that we've been talking about, certainly on the one level, things that help with depression in general are helpful. Things like exercise and keeping up interpersonal relationships and talking with people and getting out and socializing are all very helpful. sometimes other additional therapy is helpful. Whatever is helpful for the depression in general can be helpful here, as well as the medications that are typically used. The one thing that seems to be a little bit different, at least, is triggered by this notion about the sleep and the days and the shortening days, is to use light therapy. So one of the things that's particularly thought of as being helpful for these seasonal affective depressions would be light therapy.
And that's exposing yourself to a light box during a particular period of time or time of day. Is that correct?
Short of taking a trip down to the Bahamas or whatever.
That's a lot more than light therapy. That's life therapy, I think.
But yes, you typically, you know, the typical sort of thing is to have people have some sort of light box that they sit in front of, oftentimes for 20 to 30 minutes. Is sufficient for many people. And usually the most effective for most people tends to be in the early morning as well.
Are there resources that you recommend or are available to people who have more questions about seasonal affective disorder and maybe whether or not it's affecting them?
Yeah, you know, I think that the first thing to do would be, if there's a concern about the person, by the part of the people, is to talk to their physician.
Even just your family practice or general
family practice. You have to start somewhere. And, you know, depression, the problem, in answer to your question before, the depression by itself is such a very common problem in our society. And I think that more and more primary care physicians are much more tuned into looking for problems, if not dealing with them directly with the patient, and referring them to the appropriate resources for the patient to deal with. Because even if it's not seasonal that they're dealing with, they're still dealing with problems that oftentimes can be helped or managed and even treated fairly effectively.
Is there anything else that we need to learn about seasonal affective disorder that we don't know yet?
Well, I think that there's a lot to be learned. You know, what is this particular signature of this disorder that distinguishes it from other forms of depression? Knowing more details about the treatment, you know, exactly how much light is needed. Exactly what timing is best? Is it really the same for all people, or different people, based on their profile, need to be used different amounts of light at different times of the year? When should people start treating and using the light? There are a lot of things that need to be known.
That was Dr. Sanford Auerbach, Associate Professor of Neurology at Boston University School of Medicine. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Between now and 2020, we'll take some time here at Radio Boston to reflect on the past decade across a number of themes. Last week, we kicked it off with Decade in Religion. Today, we offer our second and third installments. We're going to end the hour with a look at music in the last decade, and we're going to take your calls. But first, we look at the decade in social movements. The Tea Party ring in the decade. President Trump's rallies are carrying it out.
Let me hear it. Ready? Make America great again.
In between, America rediscovered its capacity for protest and social action on a grand scale. From Black Lives Matter to hashtag MeToo, the March for Our Lives, people organized and took to the streets. So why have social movements made such a strong comeback? We asked Renee Graham, associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor, and Greg Jobin-Leeds, author of When We Fight, We Win, on 21st Century Social Movements, and co-host of the soon-to-be-released podcast of the same name. Renee started by telling us how social media has played its part.
It's changed the way that people engage social movements because they could do it immediately. They can do it worldwide. And I think, you know, a lot of the movements we saw in some cases began on social media and went from, you know, from our screens to the streets.
Greg, you've studied social movements. Some of the ones that you've talked about in the last 20 years began before the real advent of social media, but certainly seem to gain momentum afterwards. So would you second what Renee's saying, or do you think there's more going on?
There's the long through line from the anti-slavery to women's suffrage that goes all the way to today. And when you see the teacher strikes going across the country, the climate strikes, the outrage around the deportation camps, it's definitely a century that I would say that's been just awakened and just lighting up all of our lives. And I think, you know, a lot of this predates Trump. A lot of it started under President Obama, and Yes, social media has definitely helped it pick up a lot. And I think social movements always have used whatever the technologies that they had available to them.
How else would the two of you compare and contrast social movements, let's say, of the last 10 years from maybe the heyday of the 1960s, early 1970s? What else is the same? What else is different or unique now?
I mean, I think one thing that remains the same is how much it's propelled by youth. There's always a sense that the generation before you didn't quite get it done, and now you have to step up and do that. And I think of something like the Black Lives Matter movement that was started by Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, and Opal Tometi. And the whole idea, that came to life after the killing of Trayvon Martin. And it started as just this thought that one of the women wrote down, Black Lives Matter. And once she put that on social media, that connected with a lot of people. There was an energy in it that kind of said, we're not going to take this anymore. We can't sit on the sidelines. Nothing gets done when you sit on the sidelines. And so I think there was this impetus based, you know, sort of promoted by the death of Trayvon Martin and the aftermath of that trial that really pushed people to make a larger statement and more demands, you know, and to really sort of champion and protect Black existence in this country.
What were some of the other big tipping point movements of this last decade that the two of you really think made a mark?
The March for Our Lives, I think, was extraordinary. And it reminded me a lot of ACT UP in the 1980s and 90s around the AIDS crisis. And the idea that you had people who were in the middle of the crisis. They weren't looking in. They were part of what was going on, and they had to deal with their grief, but also at the same time, literally fight for their lives. So that's what people were doing in ACT UP. People were dying. They were watching their friends and lovers and neighbors die, and they watched their government do nothing. And I saw that same kind of energy in March for Your Lives after the Parkland High School shooting in Florida last year.
Yeah, and then building with the Me Too movement that certainly has added to the women's march and the hashtag Me Too, and just the what has ignited there throughout the country, and really has, I think, changed our culture, climate, obviously, and the environment. You know, the part of it is the objective reality of the wildfires and the hurricanes, the droughts and the floods. You know, Miami water is seeping through the streets. And now you have these divestment campaigns and student strikes and Extinction Rebellion and Native Americans really leading with a whole new vision of us being in tune with our ecosystem.
These were sustained campaigns. So what does it take for a moment to actually turn into a movement with the kind of sheer force of presence and sustained will to make change and carry forward?
Consider that the Me Too movement, the phrase Me Too, was started almost a decade earlier by Tarana Burke, a Black woman and a sexual assault survivor. You know, it didn't get the attention then. What made the difference was suddenly who was saying they had been affected. You know, that always plays into this. And suddenly, what you have when the New York Times and the New Yorker broke those stories about Harvey Weinstein, you had in many cases women who were famous and women who were white. And that's when people start to pay attention. You know, again, sexual harassment and misconduct in the workplace against women is not new. It's been happening as long as, you know, it's been happening forever. But suddenly it was the people who were actually being affected is what forced people to pay attention, even though Tarana Burke had been raising these issues for a decade.
Yeah, and, you know, the fact is that so many of these social movements are led by women of color, whether it's the LGBTQ movement, which started by, you know, trans women of color in New York at the Stonewall Bar, or whether it's the indigenous women in the climate movement, to the immigration movement, to prison reform. And I remember when Occupy Wall Street started, and some people were pretty annoyed that, wait, when these white kids, they're getting all the news when we've been doing this work for years, but the movements did help jump on it and continue that energy.
Let's stay with that for a minute. What is gained and lost in a social movement or the trajectory of one when people who have voice already, who are maybe more enfranchised or have privilege, self-identify as victims and add their, you know, weight or activity or action to the cause?
I think it's almost the opposite. I think it's you know, what is lost by not listening to these women of color years earlier when they're raising these issues? You know, so if everyone started paying attention to Me Too in October of 2017, then what difference would it have made if people had been listening to what Tarana Burke was trying to say a decade
earlier? 10 years earlier.
You know, maybe you get to Harvey Weinstein sooner. Maybe you get to Matt Lauer sooner. Maybe all of these men, names known and unknown, who, you know, went down in shame and you know, because of what they did, maybe that would have happened a lot sooner. But as Greg said, you know, when women of color lead, they don't follow. And so when their voices are marginalized, then the horror continues.
I want to sit with that thought for a minute. The idea that by failing to listen to the voices of marginalized people, you're not only failing to address what they're experiencing, but you're enabling perpetration for years. I mean, that's an important idea.
You know, and I think it's up to the media, which all three of us represent different aspects of the media, to be getting those voices out and to be covering those voices.
For every action, right, we know there's an equal and opposite reaction. As progressive movements gain ground for change, there will be people who are afraid of change and will act as well. Do we always see that struggle? And what does it take to get change made, given that there's always going to be that equal and opposite reaction?
You know, I mean, the history of struggle in America is intertwined with backlash, usually white backlash. We saw it during the Reconstruction era, you know, backlash with Jim Crow. But if you think about the number of people who were being lynched to get their basic civil and voting rights, it didn't stop people from continuing to do it. You know, that's the thing. There's always going to be a backlash. But the question always becomes, how important are your rights? Do you acquiesce or do you keep fighting even at the risk of your own life? I think, you know, the backlash is always expected, but I don't know that it's ever been a deterrent from people who are demanding to be treated like human beings.
Are we in a certain cultural moment right now because social movement has become so much more a part of how people are taking political action? What's changed in our broader culture as a result?
I think the engagement is good. I remember attending the Women's March in 2017, the day after the inauguration, and talking to a lot of women who said, I've never attended a march before. I've never been to a protest before. And there's something about the urgency of the moment and the urgency that people have felt in the last 10 years that is really inspiring. There isn't this, you know, there's, I think more than ever in the last 2 or 3 years now, there's a sense that the government alone is not going to save us.
Do you think that people sustain after that first sort of toe in the water or sign in the air, Renee?
I think some have. I mean, I think they've just done it in different ways. I mean, I think I'm as surprised as everyone that there aren't more street protests with some of the things that have been going on lately in the government. However, I think people are mobilizing in different ways. So there was all this complaint after 2017 that, oh, well, you know, the Women's March was just one-off and nothing really happened. But then we got to 2018 and we saw the midterm elections. So that's how it mobilized in 2018. It wasn't just a matter of people with pink hats gathering in parks around the world. It was people going to the ballot box and making a difference there. And I think that's the same kind of movement. You know, that's a continuation of the movement that we saw in 2017.
That was Renee Graham, associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor, and Greg Jobin-Leeds, author of When We Fight, We Win, a book on 21st century social movements, also co-host of the soon-to-be-released podcast of the same name. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll take your calls on the decade in music. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. Between now and 2020, we're going to take time here at Radio Boston to reflect on the past decade in a number of themes. For the rest of today's show, it's going to be music, starting with some of the Globe's biggest pop hits. Despacito. Quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído. Oppa Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op. Oppa Gangnam Style. Oh my, my, my. Oh my, my.
that's Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee's Despacito, Camila Cabello's Havana, Gangnam Style by Psy's, and BTS and Halsey's Boy with Love. You should have seen it here in the my guests across from the table. We're shifting to some different kind of beats during that montage. And they're here to talk with us about the 2010s in music and how we listen to music. We have Melissa Farrick. She's a musician and professor at Northeastern University. Welcome back, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Tim Riley. He's a music critic with NPR and associate professor at Emerson College. Hi there, Tim.
Hi there.
And we have you. What about you? What was the most important music of the decade to you? How much did you change how you listen, what you listened to, who you listened to? What's your nominee for the big theme of the past decade in music? Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, so Melissa, I'll start with you. If you could pick a thematic through line for music in the last decade, what would it be?
All borders down, I think.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So say some more about that.
Yeah, well, just the fact that this, you know, we finally, like, BTS is the first Korean band ever, you know, to top the U.S. Billboard charts. I just love that. And then this Blackpink, right, the girl group, I just checked them out online before I came over here, and they are the most subscribed artists on YouTube.
Huh.
Like, it's amazing. A Korean girl band, you know? It's just awesome. So I feel like overall, from Despacito to the K-pop world to country smashing pop to just like all the borders are down now. It's just everything's fair game, and you can, you know, I could feel good about doing a instrumental jazz record if I wanted it.
Tim, how about you?
Yeah,
what's your
I'd theme? Agree with that, and I'd point out that Despacito, in particular, it's a foreign language hit, mm-hmm. and you just, you know, you'd have to really think really hard. When was the last time we had a non-English language major hit like that? It's really fascinating, and it makes me wonder how, like, that's going to start happening a lot
all
more. Why has that happened yet?
You know? I'm thinking back to when, okay, I'm going to date myself here.
No good. Yeah.
But when it was a big deal that the phrase La Vida Loca
was
in a pop song in the United States, and now we've got, you know, music coming from all over the world, coming in, influencing culture and the way we listen and what we listen to, it does seem to be kind of exciting.
Yeah, I really like that, how the Korean popsters are, you know, they're not just popular, they are masters of a genre,
mm-hmm.
and they're really showing everyone else how to do any genre, just up to the hilt, and it's very exciting, even if you don't like the genre. But there's something very scintillating about what they're doing, even if it's sort of like if it follows a template and it follows some guidelines.
Listeners, I'm going to ask you what I'm about to ask our guests here. One or two artists that stand out for you so completely over the last decade. What would your one or two artists be? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pull up a seat at the table. Melissa, how about you? One or two artists, big standouts of the last decade.
I'm going to go with Frank Ocean. I don't know if I can do more than this. Marshmello. That's not even my go-to music. I'm just telling you, like, as far as, like, who has completely blown me away. I mean, I can't not say Lizzo. I can't not say that.
I love
her. She's just incredible. Just incredible.
What do you love about her?
Everything. I like her honesty, her youth, her inclusiveness, her voice, the fact that when she sings, she is completely connected to something bigger than herself. She's a truth-driven artist. She's saving a lot of young people's lives, I think, and giving older people, maybe like me, you know, I'm not that old, but at 49, to see someone like that come out with that kind of bravery.
Yep.
I'm psyched. I'm psyched about the next 20 years of music I get to listen to.
Let's listen to a montage of women artists from the last decade,
sure,
who have been, you know, standouts.
Thought I'd end up with Sean, but it wasn't a match. Wrote some songs about Ricky. Now I listen and laugh. Even like a Texas Bama.
Okay, I wish we could just keep playing that. But what you had there was Ariana Grande, Beyonce, Lady Gaga, Taylor Swift, and Lizzo. Now, not in chronological order, and actually kind of a wide variety of sound that we're hearing there. But I feel like if you put those in order chronologically, mm-hmm. it's almost like you can't get Lizzo unless you have those other women breaking ground in the places they did. And I could go back 20 years before that and say, you start with Madonna, right?
Sure.
And you move your way through. So how does the end of the decade show the tale or the influence of the beginning of the decade? I'll turn to you first, Tim.
Oh, well, that's a really wonderful question. I mean, first of all, we're talking diversity, right? But when I teach rock and roll history at Emerson, I concentrate on four major themes: race, class, demographics, and gender, right? And those are classic American tensions, right, between what is normal in those zones and what is not normal, right? The outsiders, the insiders, and all of those different spheres. And what we see in mainstream pop is this sort of like stretching and contracting and expanding of the what is acceptable in creative terms on all those different levels. And in this decade, it's really been highly focused on gender and I would say demographics. I have never felt more of a generation gap in my lifetime than when I was coming of age in the 1970s and there was a war on. And that the generation gap was very pronounced. It was very defining. The music was all about that generation gap. And we're seeing that play out again today. My kids, 19 and 22, listen to completely different music than I do. And their identity is all wrapped up in that music, and the OK Boomer thing is just huge in our house. It's wonderful to see another generation gap emerging.
Melissa, what would you add?
I would just add that I think what I'm noticing, even as you played that mashup there, how much I'm really excited about the female voice or the female identified voice as being one that is free of just being pretty with vibrato. You know, we're hearing that kind of like anger, like the Grace Jones, the Laurie Anderson, the kind of, you know, when I think about the Patti Smith, the women who were heroes of mine from like the, like Blondie, you know, like when she would just speak, Blondie was like one of the first women to rap. And what I'm hearing at the end with Lizzo specifically, just because I'm like such a big fan, is just this, you know, just like she's not afraid to just give the anger or the contempt or the frustration or the certainty with her voice in a way that isn't sprinkled with, you know, with rainbow colored sprinkles, I guess. That's the metaphor I'm seeing in my head.
I love it. Let's take a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Ed's calling from Holden. I think you have a nominee, Ed. Is that right?
I do. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Well, I have to give a shout out to a local band, and I know that they're like black licorice. You either really like it or you don't like it at all, but it's the band Phish.
Everyone was wondering what you were going to say, Ed. I was like, what's this black licorice
thing? Let me give you some examples. This is a band that's been around for about 35 years. They've never had a hit record. They get very little airplay, yet they can sell out four nights at Madison Square Garden over New Year's in seconds. That holds 23,000 people. But a couple of years back, and this is what's remarkable about them, they did a 13-night residency at Madison Square Garden, and they play two sets a night, no backup band, about 3.5 hours per show. They did not repeat one song in 13 shows.
Sounds like it was a pretty amazing performance. So let me turn to our panelists because they look pensive. We sort of have among our team here, when somebody scratches their chin at what you've said, you're not sure they agree with you. So, Tim?
Well, I liked what my friend Brett Milano said about Phish. He said, oh, I wish I liked Phish as much as these people seem to really like Phish. Now, I have a lot of respect for the musicianship, and obviously, whatever floats your boat, if you're a fan, I don't want to take away from your enjoyment of a band at all. It's not a band that's going to leave it's not a band with a legacy catalog, let's say that. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to walk around saying, oh, I want to hear that song that Phish did, right? And one of the things Phish is really good at is doing other people's songs. So some of the times when they do these 13-night runs, they'll play the Beatles' whole White Album, right?
Oh, okay.
Which is a fantastic feat.
Cool.
I wouldn't take that away from anybody, but it's not about putting original stuff out there. So I have my qualms about Phish.
Let's take another call. We've got Eric on the line from Salem, New Hampshire. Hi, Eric. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to talk about I moved here from California 15 years ago and came to age around here and went to the old Axis and Avalon and so forth and saw bigger bands. But the local influence of bands as big as, let's say, Lake Street Dive right now, who kind of exploded recently, and then other lesser-known people like Ryan Montbleu and so forth, to go to a big show at TD Bank Garden, let's say the last one I went to was Tool. Awesome. Mm. Amazing. Always been a Tool fan. But to go to a small club like the Paseum in Cambridge and see Montbleu, or to go up to the higher ground in Burlington and see Lake Street Dive, or to go to Portland and see another band like Moonhooch, which is totally off the other end of the chart.
Let's turn that to Melissa, actually, Eric, because interestingly, she's actually got a couple shows coming up at Paseum herself on the 26th and the 27th of December. How about this local music
scene?
Yeah,
I love it. You know, and you know, Ryan used to open for me, and then now he's wicked famous in the folk world, you know? I mean, I love that guy. I love Lake Street Dive. I mean, these are all, we talked about this when we started to come on the show today, was what kind of music are we going to focus on? You know, because I'm the Americana singer-songwriter, all, you know, alt-country person. That's my wheelhouse. And I would love to have coffee with you, man, if you're up in Salem, New Hampshire. It sounds like we like all the same bands. And there's a validity to that. And there's a validity to being a troubadour who does 200 shows a year like Ryan, you know, and make a living off that and give back to the people who've helped you and give back to younger artists. There's just no comparison. You can't compare Lil Nas and Ryan Montbleu.
Okay, so I'm actually going to pick up on that and take advantage of your introduction into country and Americana, because we've got a little bit of a montage of some of Tim's country music favorites here. And let's... Good Lord, what a voice. We had there Miranda Lambert, Kacey Musgraves, and Brandi Carlile. You know, I grew up in the Midwest, and when I go back there now, every radio station is a country music radio station,
right.
But this is not the music I'm hearing. Mm. So it does feel like this has been an interesting decade for country around what is country, what gets through in country, whether women are allowed to be creative and original in country. Yeah. Tim, since those were some of your favorites, I'll start with you. Melissa, I want to turn to you on this as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, yeah, there's a lot to talk about here. I mean, country has gone so far into pop. It's veered so much more to the center than it ever did. But there's also just been this horrible misogyny story this year where these really great country and western singers can't get heard on country radio. And that's why they formed the High Women with Brandi Carlile and Natalie Hemby and Maren Morris and Amanda Shires, because they felt the need for a supergroup to actually use their leverage to get on country radio. So radio has been irrelevant for so long. It's just kind of dismal to think that we're still having this argument, because these people are all they have already gained their importance and shown their influence without radio. But the idea that radio is dragging its heels is just really – it's just shameless. It's just – that we it shouldn't be a story.
Melissa.
It's making me think about a couple things. I love all those acts. I think first I just want to say what we notice in this music is incredible melody. And I think that that's the thing that separates fantastic country or songwriter-driven music from the hip-hop stuff that we hear. But since hip-hop has now surpassed rock music to become the biggest genre in the United States, what I have known for a long time is that country music is pop music. You know, and R&B and blues and rap are what pop music used to be. We've just switched places here. And radio, terrestrial radio, is that how you say that word?
Yes.
That word's so weird. Is still so powerful, and it pays well. So unfortunately, you know, artists do want to get on regular radio, right? The royalty rate is better. And people listen to it. I mean, I know everyone's streaming, but there's a real validity to getting a hit on the radio.
So I want to just kind of close out the country music. You talked about R&B yeah. and hip hop. We got to play this next one.
I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm
can't no more. I got the horses in the back.
Now, for the record, I do not think you need Billy Ray Cyrus for Lil Nas X to have made a country song.
Thank you.
But it is interesting that he was kind of locked out of a whole genre. You talked about the women being locked out.
Well,
what the heck here? I mean, that is country and it's awesome. So why would anybody not want to be playing or welcoming
racism?
That music? There you go. Let's just put that on the table.
I mean, but we should also just note that, like, Jimi Hendrix had the same problem, right? He ascended very quickly into the top tier of rock, classic rock and roll people, but his audience was largely white. Okay, and he could not get a record contract for the longest time because he was a person of color who was playing loud guitar rock. So he had to go to Britain to get his record contract. This is just this entrenched thinking that we have in this culture, and it's wonderful to see when a record like this breaks through because, it has aspects of a novelty record, but it's a novelty record in all the right ways, right? And a person of color finally, and YOLO had another great country record this year, and she's British person of color singing country soul, great record.
Yeah, and Nas is gay.
Right. Let's not forget.
That's a big deal. Yeah. So he's black, he's gay, he's a hip-hop artist, and now he's got a hit at country radio, and it should have been a hit at country without Billy Ray, but thank God for Billy Ray, right? So it's like this was just like this is now at week 7. This was the longest number one hit ever. Right? Number 17 weeks, that song at radio.
All right, let's pick up a little montage here of hip-hop, rap, and R&B
I want to talk about Nas more. I mean, that's
just... Well, wait then. No, what else do you want to talk about
with
Nas? No,
I just think it's like such a moment, and I'm so psyched. Like, I couldn't believe he was gay. When that came out, I was like, what? He's gay?
Yeah, I love that, too. His timing was great.
It
was
like talking about?
It was like the perfect marketing campaign,
right? He doesn't look gay. The song doesn't sound gay.
You can't see Melissa's quote marks as she's talking.
You're so upset that I'm black. Oh, P.S., I'm gay. I love that.
And I'm going to get on country radio.
Right. So rather than go to the next montage, then, no, let me ask you this. Are we in the next decade, then, going to see an identity mashup of music? And what's that going to mean for creativity and groundbreaking sound? Or am I being overly optimistic because we also still have people getting locked out of their genres?
Well, no, both things keep happening, right? So we're going to see the old fighting against the new, like we always do, right? But there's a lot of happening technologically that's going to really accelerate all the change, which is the global thing where people in India have their streaming services. YouTube is much more popular over there, right? In America, we tend to think, oh, we're the center of the universe, so everything that's here is what translates over there. No. Yeah. TikTok is Chinese, came over here, and it's huge over here. TikTok will be breaking music acts, right? Mm-hmm. Music acts are going to be infiltrating these social media things. And when we get participation from India and from Africa and from China, and that dialogue starts to happen, I think we're going to hear lots of really cool creative new sounds.
All right, we've got about a minute left here, and I want to bracket some of the artists we lost across a couple of generations.
Right.
So in one generation, you had artists like Aretha Franklin, David Bowie, B.B. King, Prince, Tom Petty, too many to name. We also lost a lot of young artists, Nipsey Hussle, Mac Miller, Avicii, Amy Winehouse. Mm-hmm. How do we process those losses, Melissa?
You got Mac Miller. I just want to say him, too, and Chester Bennington, Lil Peep, and Dolores O'Riordan from Cranberries, right?
Oh,
and
I
then this
Dolores
most recent, Kelly Ray Harris, country. Yeah. So what was the question? Sorry,
so how
it's
do
just
we
so
process
sad.
It? Yeah. Well, maybe we just process it by being sad for the loss.
I think the young people, and this is, we talked, Tim and I were talking briefly about this, the intersection of psychopathology and creativity, and there's a ton of this, right? So there's a lot of talk about mental illness and addiction, and there's a lot of ways that we can help young artists. And you know, when you see someone like David Bowie finally succumb, you know, he passed away of liver disease, but that guy was sober for a long, 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 long time, you know? And I think the more people can be out about the struggles they've had, then the better off we're all going to be.
All right, we are going to go out on Prince's Purple Rain, because if you grew up when I did, well, Purple Rain.
Yeah.
Prince died in April of 2016 at the age of 57. Melissa Farrick is a musician and professor at Northeastern University. She's going to perform at Passim on December 26th and 27th. Thanks for joining us. And Tim Riley, a music critic with NPR and associate professor at Emerson College, where he directs their graduate program. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
We are into the music here. I am Tiziana Deering. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.